Welcome to the Freshfields podcast. This is the first podcast in the Rewarding Half Hour series brought to you by the Freshfields Reward Team. I'm David Mendel and I'm here with my colleague Alice Greenwell, and we're both partners in the London Reward Team, and we're recording this episode from our London office.
Thanks, David. Maybe you could tell us what we're doing with the Rewarding Half Hour.
Well, it's our term for all the content on executive reward in 2024. So it won't just be this podcast series, but we will put out blogs and other materials on topics related to reward.
Excellent. The plan for today is that we are talking about being prepared for the unexpected. So do you want to tell us what we're actually going to cover?
When we were thinking about this first podcast, we had in mind a sort of imagined scenario where an executive director is leaving a company and someone in the reward team is going to talk to the chair of the remuneration committee about that executive who's leaving. And they're preparing themselves really for two things. Firstly, all the elements of an exit package that the chair might want to discuss and might want to know whether they can deliver to that departing executive or not. And then secondly, our hypothetical person working in the reward team wants to have a list of things that they really need to remember to tell the chair and that they shouldn't forget. And that's what we want to cover today.
Perfect. I think that probably sounds quite ambitious for half an hour. So maybe for today, we just focus on listed companies. There are obviously lots of reward issues for private companies, but we can pick those up elsewhere in the Rewarding Half Hour series. Thinking about your hypothetical reward person, is there one key area that they should start from when they're thinking about this?
I think there are actually two, if I can be allowed to have two. The first is the executive's employment contract. That will obviously drive and dictate some of the payments that may need to be made to the individual or terms that may apply. And perhaps we can come back to that a little later. And then the second big area is the remuneration policy regime and the policy that the company has. That will be familiar landscape to lots of people, but as a reminder, it's that section in the annual report that sets out the company's policy on what it can pay to its directors. And that includes all elements of pay, so salary, benefits, pension, long-term incentive arrangements whilst someone is a director. But it will also pick up, if it's well drafted, all the things that you might want to pay when someone leaves. And the reason that that policy is important is because the policy is subject to a binding shareholder vote every 3 years. And if you want to make payments to a director, they need to be consistent with that policy. Any payments that you make that are inconsistent with the policy are void. They are held on trust by the receiving individual for the company. And the members of the remuneration committee who will have authorised those payments are also liable in respect of those payments that have been made. So the REM policy for me is the first reference point for any payments that need to be made. If it's not in the policy, it can't be done unless you get separate shareholder approval for that. So the starting point is really looking at the policy on the payments for departing directors, and that will hopefully give you flexibility for putting a package together.
Okay, so that essentially means if you've got a well-drafted policy, you should be fine, because that should just give you the flexibility to go ahead and do what you want. It can't be as simple as that, surely.
It's probably not as simple as that. And I'm conscious we've got half an hour to fill and we shouldn't be done in 5 minutes. So no, it is more complicated than that. Just because a remuneration policy allows a company to make particular payments to a departing executive doesn't mean that they should make those payments or that they will make use of the full flexibility. One of the things that companies need to consider is the disclosure environment. So what will they need to disclose to the market about what they're agreeing with someone who is leaving? And really, when we're talking about a listed company environment, the starting assumption is it's everything that is disclosable. But there are multiple ways and different avenues in which these sorts of arrangements would get disclosed. There are obviously already some announcement obligations on things like share plan awards when they vest. That may not be relevant to someone who departs employment, because it's only when they are a so-called PDMR that you need to make public announcements about share plan vestings. But there are other requirements on disclosure for someone who leaves. So, for example, companies need to put out what's called a Section 430(2B) statement. It's a statement on the website about remuneration payments that are made to a director after they have ceased to be a director. And the obligation is to put that out when a director actually steps down. But lots of companies, when they first announce that a director is leaving, they will say in their RNS, these are the payments that we intend to make to this individual. That is not mandatory, but there is a bit of market practice for doing that. Market practice does vary on that, though. And then the big one, I suppose, is the annual report. The director's remuneration report put out each year needs to disclose what payments have been made to someone who has left during the year. It's worth remembering that there are different timings for those announcements. So each case will be different, because it may be that when an executive leaves, there's quite a long period of time before you need to announce anything formally about the terms that apply to that individual. And that may be a relevant consideration. All of these points on disclosure are relevant because companies want to think about investor, shareholder, wider stakeholder reaction. It may be that if shareholders are not happy with the payments that are being made to a departing director, that they vote against the remuneration report in the annual report, or they vote against the remuneration policy. They may, in more extreme circumstances, vote against the reappointment of the person who's acting as Remco chair. So there can be very serious consequences for putting a package together that doesn't meet shareholder expectation. And companies don't like to ignore general market and press reaction as well. All our listeners will have seen in the press the debate over executive pay in the UK, and that's connected with the perceived lack of competitiveness of the London market with, for example, the US. But this is a sensitive issue, and that needs to be taken into account as well. Turning the tables, Alice, and I suppose sort of in that context of investor sentiment, I was wondering what you see when you think about the payments that need to be made to executive directors versus the spectrum of things that could be paid, or where a Remco chair might want to explore the art of the possible.
It's very easy to talk about packages and good leaver status in the abstract. I think one of the challenges for remuneration committees, against that backdrop of kind of disclosure and media interest that you've talked about, is that you've got a real life individual who is sat there and you're dealing with the termination of their employment. And in many cases, that is going to be done in a very swift manner because of the public disclosure requirements. And it's going to be very much in the public eye. The fact of the termination will be in the public eye. Everything they're being paid is going to be in the public eye. And so it's understandable why remuneration committees grapple with what the right package is for an individual in that scenario. Now, clearly, the type of package is going to depend very heavily on the reasons for the departure. A retirement, for example, is going to look very different from a misconduct dismissal. In the most straightforward of cases, I'd say that's probably a resignation where the executive has elected to leave themselves. And it may be there that the executive just works their notice period. They are not a good leaver under any of the share plans. And so all of their equity lapses. And that's just kind of relatively straightforward and plays out simply. Where you've got a company instigated departure, there's a real spectrum between a sort of perceived underperformer, but who you need to manage out gently, and who for good reason you might want to give good leaver status to, but want to balance that against not rewarding for failure, through to the other end of the spectrum where you've got somebody who is leaving who is very much seen as a high performer, and that needs to be recognised in their departure terms, and a lot of grey in between those. And at the same time, potentially managing different scenarios. The fact that you want this transition in the executive team to be smooth, you might have particular projects ongoing that you need ongoing support with and focus on. So yes, there's a sort of question about good leaver status under the share plans, but we often see and get asked the question about what else can we do? What are the other levers that we can potentially pull in putting together a package? I think it's fair to say that the remuneration policy has cut off lots of the levers that we used to have available to us. In a scenario where you are dealing with an employee who is not an executive director, so you're not constrained by the remuneration policy, it's very easy because you've got the ability to make ex gratia payments. If you think that a payment is justified, you can make that to the employee. Where you're constrained by the REM policy, you can't do that. And so you end up having to look for other avenues that you can sort of find that additional value. One of the things we used to see a lot of was companies delaying the start of notice periods. So you'd announce that the executive was going. You'd then start the search for the successor, and the notice period would only start when the successor has been appointed or started in role, which kind of had the effect of effectively extending the notice period. Perhaps unsurprisingly, investors have alighted on that as a bit of a potential abuse and said that they don't like it as a practice and will generally expect notice periods to start running straight away. So there's less flexibility there for sure than there used to be. Similarly, we have seen companies use consultancy arrangements that run after the end of notice periods where they need to secure ongoing cooperation or whatever it might be with particular projects. But again, companies have to be very careful in how they use those consultancy arrangements because they do need to be genuine consultancy arrangements. They can't just be disguised termination payments that are wrapped up in a consultancy where the individual's not really going to be expected to do anything.
And on that consultancy point, would you expect there to be any disclosure around consultancy arrangements, or is that quite a tricky question?
That is a tricky question. It's tricky for two reasons. One is you potentially have to worry about related party transaction rules. So you need to just look at those and work out where you've got an issue from a shareholder approval disclosure perspective under those, which has nothing to do with the REM side. That's a listing rule requirement. From a REM perspective, there is a carve out that would mean if it is a genuine consultancy for services being provided as a consultant after they've ceased to be a director, there is no disclosure obligation. That there's a sort of an exemption in the regulations for it. But again, you have to do the sniff test on it. Is it a genuine consultancy or is it in fact a disguised remuneration payment?
Okay. Can I just bring you back to equity and share plan award, because the way in which you put it was it sounds like there's quite a lot of discretion for the remuneration committee to reflect on the type of lever that someone is and then decide how the equity should be treated. But I've certainly seen some executives, when they're being hired, ask whether their lever status can be guaranteed upfront and contractualized. Is that something you've seen, and what are the challenges with that?
Yeah, for sure. I think we're seeing a definite uptick in executives looking to negotiate that on the way in. And I think there's probably a couple of reasons for that. The first is it's a more normal practice in the US that there are these concepts of resignation for good reason or termination without cause. And there is a very clear termination package that flows from each of those. So the executive has certainty about what they will receive in the event of their dismissal. So I think that's one reason. I think even outside that, in the world of private equity, for example, management are used to negotiating the good lever, bad lever terms on their management incentive plans. It's not something that is just imposed on them by the company unilaterally. So again, I think we're seeing a bit of that feed through into the listed company environment. And I think there's just also now a growing awareness of the shackles that a remuneration committee feels it operates under because of the public scrutiny. And I think advisors to executives are now much more alive to the fact that they are most likely to achieve the positive outcome for the executives if they try and agree that on the way in, when everybody's very happy about the shiny new executive that they're recruiting, rather than at the point they leave where everybody might have got a bit bad tempered with each other. I think the only other thing I would say about that preordained lever treatment is to see it from both sides of the fence, because I think sometimes the executives expect there to be a certainty of treatment. But actually also we're finding with members of remuneration committees who are used to US style compensation arrangements, they're also a little bit taken aback in some scenarios that there is so much decision making at the point of an executive leaving, and that there isn't just a kind of formulaic, this is the answer to how we structure somebody's termination package.
So perhaps bringing this back to my hypothetical person in reward who's going off for a conversation with the Remco chair, let's imagine then that we've got our proposed package, that conversation has taken place, we know it's compliant with REM policy, we've worked through all the announcement obligations, we're happy with that. How should these arrangements be documented?
That, in my view, is a question that doesn't get asked enough.
I'm glad I asked it.
There is, I think, a tendency to default to needing to wrap everything up in a settlement agreement. And I think it's right in a lot of circumstances that you will want to do that. And maybe just pausing, by settlement agreement, I mean a formal document where the executive has got legal advice and has waived all of their claims against the company, both contractual and statutory employment claims. There are potential pros and cons to entering into a settlement agreement, and I do think it is worth companies just pausing and thinking about those and deciding whether it is actually the right course of action for them. Clearly, if there's a litigation kind of risk in the mix, contentious circumstances around the termination, then getting that waiver of claims is going to be valuable. And a settlement agreement can pick up lots of non-remuneration related items. So classically, it would cover agreement on the announcement. You know, what is the announcement going to say? What's the messaging going to be? Who's responsible for delivering that? It can pick up things like support with ongoing investigations to make sure that you've got the cooperation of the individual on an ongoing basis. And it can also provide clarity on both the timing and process for things like coming off boards or stepping down from any other roles that the executive holds. Those are all really good things to get agreed and documented very clearly. But if you are, as a company, treating somebody as a good leaver, so they're getting their equity awards, they're either working or being paid out for their notice period, and you're not really in a scenario where there's any sort of particular litigation risk, a settlement agreement and looking to enter into a settlement agreement can slow things down and can make an exit more expensive than it might be. So just to explain that, executive terminations can be inside information that can bring with it a whole host of disclosure obligations. That's not the subject matter of what we're talking about today. But you do need to bear in mind that a settlement agreement will take time to negotiate, and you may not have the luxury of that time if you are up against an impending announcement obligation because of the inside information analysis. Coupled with that, the fact that a lawyer will be involved in the settlement agreement process will likely lead to an increase in the costs associated with the termination. I say this carefully because I'm conscious that I am a lawyer myself, but inevitably, once an executive goes and talks to a lawyer about the terms of the settlement agreement, that is likely, if the lawyer is doing their job, to lead to the executive asking for additional items in the package. In the worst case scenarios I've seen, lawyers advising executives have literally taken the remuneration policy and used it as a shopping list. So they've gone down the payments for loss of office section of the policy and seen all the items that the company has diligently included as things they might pay. And the lawyer has just put them on the table saying, well, it says you can pay outplacement. We'd like outplacement, please. It says you can pay legal fees, relocation allowance. We'd like those as well, please. That's relatively rare, but it is something that you have to factor in deciding whether it's the right thing to do or not.
And there's sort of no avoiding the involvement of a lawyer if you want a settlement agreement, at least in the UK, right? Because you need, in order for the waiver of claims to be valid, at least in relation to statutory employment claims, you need legal advice on that agreement.
Yeah, totally. And I guess the reason why I think it's a question that companies should be asking themselves is, how likely is it for the executive to be bringing a statutory employment claim? And can you wrap all of the arrangements up around the termination in a simple kind of letter that the company is sending to the executive that deals with lots of the things that you might well deal with in a settlement agreement, but that doesn't have that statutory overlay on it? You can even, with that structure, have the executive waive contractual claims. So the only thing that you are really missing between the two is the unfair dismissal claim or discrimination claims, so those statutory employment claims. Obviously, everything will be fact-specific and dependent on the circumstances, but I would say 9 times out of 10, the real risk of an executive bringing one of those claims is actually very small.
You heard it here first. I mean, one of the areas where I've sometimes thought it can be useful to have a settlement agreement, or to think about it at least, is when you're thinking about restrictive covenants, by which I mean non-competes, non-solicits that apply for a period of time after termination of employment. And those tend to be pretty fact-specific as to whether a company cares about them or not in a given case. So there may be circumstances where, for example, an executive is genuinely retiring, the importance of a non-compete in that scenario, it may just not be there for the company. But there may be scenarios when you do care about the non-compete because you think they may move to a competitor in the same sector. Or you may not care about the non-compete, but you care about the non-solicitation because they're a really valuable senior management and people in your team, and you're worried about them being poached. If those provisions are important, and the existing covenants, because there are normally covenants in an employment contract for an executive, if those existing covenants are robust and they cover the required ground, then what you would often do, if you do anything at all, is just restate them at termination. It's really just reminding the executive that they are bound by those restrictions. And you don't need a full settlement agreement for that. You can build it into some of the documentation that you've talked about, something that's a bit simpler. But if the employment contract doesn't contain a great set of covenants, or it doesn't quite cover the stuff that you are worried about as a company, then you might be looking to agree new covenants as part of termination arrangements. If you think about it from the executive's perspective, they might be tempted to say, well, that's fine, I may be prepared to agree to those, but I want paying for that commitment, because what they're agreeing to do is to keep themselves out of the market for a period of time or to otherwise restrict their activities. And one of the ways in which companies can try to navigate that is on good leaver status. If the status hasn't been built in up front, as we talked about earlier, it may be possible to say, well, one of the conditions for us treating you as a good leaver on a discretionary basis is your continued compliance with these covenants that we're now going to put in place. If you're not in that world and you are thinking about whether to actually pay someone monetary compensation for them staying out of the market or entering into a non-solicit, there's a real debate to be had about how much that should be. Because at one extreme, an executive will say, well, if you want me to be out of the market, not competing for 12 months, I want to be paid a full salary, benefits, other arrangements for that 12-month period. That, in the listed company environment, with all the investor expectations, would be a pretty punchy thing for a company to agree to do. And most remuneration policies wouldn't allow it in the first place. But that would be, to come back to where we started, the first place to look at that REM policy and see if it gives you any flexibility there. I said that companies might be more relaxed if someone is retiring from executive life, but it is worth remembering that often executives will then go off and do NED roles. They'll go and become a non-executive on another listed company board. And it can be a little bit embarrassing for companies if their former CEO turns up pretty quickly as a NED on a company board in the same sector, for example. And that might be an area where it's worth focusing on the covenants and the restrictions that you want. And likewise, consultancy roles that they may go on to do. The executive might actually be quite an attractive prospect to, for example, a private equity house who is looking to get into a particular sector. And that former CEO, CFO may be a great consultant for them, particularly if they're sniffing around for possible bids So again, thinking about what the current restrictions say in the employment contract, do you need anything else? Do you have enough protection through confidentiality arrangements, or do you need something else on top of it? So quite a lot to work through. I feel like there's probably a topic we've forgotten, Alice. And what else does our hypothetical person need to be thinking about?
I think I've got two things for them to think about. The first is a relatively minor one, but post-employment shareholding requirements. 9 out of 10 companies have them. Worth just thinking about getting agreement as to what the number of shares are that somebody is going to have to hold on to and what the dates are that they're running from and to. You know, is that when they step down from the board? Is that when they actually cease to be an employee? And what share price are you using to calculate the number? So I think that's one just to keep on the radar. The other, which is the slightly bigger point, is just keeping an eye on malice and clawback and making sure that in whatever decisions the remuneration committee is making about the package for a departing executive, they preserve the ability to operate malice and clawback. Now, at its simplest, that is just making sure that awards continue to vest on their existing vesting dates and the existing malice and clawback provisions continue to bite on those awards. There will be pressure from executives occasionally to accelerate the vesting of awards. It's obviously open to a remuneration committee to do that if the REM policy allows it, if the share plan rules allow it. But that puts you in the territory as a company that you would have to operate clawback if you needed to recover any of those awards rather than malice. That's harder. So the REMCO needs to be thinking about that when it's making its decisions. The other places where it's particularly worth thinking about this are if you don't think your existing malice and clawback provisions are robust enough, and that might just be because through passage of time, they haven't kept up with where market practice is. And so do you want to impose more robust malice and clawback provisions and use the good leaver status as a way of securing those? So you make good leaver status conditional on an executive agreeing to new malice and clawback provisions. But the other scenario is if there are circumstances in play at the point of termination, that means you want to look at the periods that you've got to operate malice and clawback over. Do you need to extend those? Because you know there's something going on that's not going to get resolved before the awards run out of time. So again, just keeping an eye on that and factoring that into the thinking. I think we're approaching time. So David, unless you tell me there is something that we've forgotten to remind our reward director and remuneration committee members about, I think we'll wrap it up there.
I could talk about this for hours, but I think that's a good idea.
Thank you for listening to us. We hope you found it interesting and informative. We also hope you'll join us for our next episode, where we will be looking at transatlantic remuneration issues and bridging the US-UK divide, where so often it looks and sounds the same, but actually is quite different. In the meantime, if you have any questions or would like any support with any of the things that we've discussed, please reach out to David or to me or to any of your usual Freshfields contacts.